You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for a reporter roundtable, when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines around our area this past week. Our panel today, Aaron Bamer with the Idaho Press, Troy Oppie with Boise State Public Radio News, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Rachel Cohen with Boise State Public Radio News. Happy Friday, everyone.
Hi there.
Hi, Gemma.
Hello.
Hello. Happy Friday.
So let's start with the governor's news conference, which happened yesterday. We're going to play a little bit of sound from that.
Due to the sacrifices Idahoans have made in the past 2 months and the care they have shown for their neighbors, I am hopeful that we pass the worst of COVID-19 in our state if we all continue to routinely practice measures to prevent its spread. Today, I am pleased to announce that we have met the criteria to enter stage 3 of our Idaho Rebounds plan to safely and responsibly open our economy.
So we will be entering phase 3 come Saturday. And Don, I know that you were listening in on that news conference. Can you kind of get us updated? Because there were some changes that the governor made about stage 3.
Yeah, and he made a couple of what I would call fairly minor changes, the biggest of which will be that movie theaters can open in stage 3 instead of stage 4. Those theaters will have to abide by social distancing practices. Now, it's interesting to note that there are no new release movies scheduled to come out until mid-July, and there hasn't been a single one since March. So it might be a little symbolic. Maybe theaters could open up with some second run or some classic type of things. But he has kind of ever so slightly eased some of these restrictions, earlier announcing that bars would move from stage 4 to stage 3. And I think, you know, it's interesting. It's hard to know what's in somebody's head, but I think there's been some response to some of the criticism, while at the same time still trying to put together a measured and reasonable plan for the state.
And with that, he also was asked, was he not, Don, during the news conference about mask wearing, yeah, like if you go to a grocery store, and he was pretty firm on that response.
Sure, and I don't think you have the soundbite, so I'll read it because it's really easy. So Joe Paris over at KTVB asked, what's the guidance? Should you be wearing a mask in a retail store, in a grocery store? And Little responded, yes. And then he paused for, it felt like 4 hours, but it was probably about 5 seconds. And then he went on a pretty long answer about masks. And he said, quote, my mask is for you. What you are doing is being respectful, particularly of the clerk who waits on you. I'm very proud of the people of Idaho. I was guilty. I was one of those people that saw wearing a mask as, well, there's a paranoid soul. Coronavirus is different. And then he said, wearing a mask is just the right thing to do. So I think he went on at length about mask wearing and encouraging people to do it. This has been a debate, and some people are wearing them and some people aren't. And I don't want to wade into the reasons for that, but the governor is very much coming out on the side of, hey, let's wear a mask and let's watch out for our neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been politicized. I mean, let's that's fair to say. Yet we have, you know, scientists, our state epidemiologist. I mean, when she walked up to the podium yesterday, she had a mask on. She took it off to talk, right?
To be at the news conference, it's required that you wear a mask. I wasn't able to attend yesterday, but I went to one last week. And so the state's asking and requiring reporters even to wear masks in the briefings.
Right. And Rachel, what was your take on the news conference? Because I know you listened into it as well.
Yeah. And I wouldn't say, I would agree with Don that I think that most of the, you know, changes were probably incremental. I think probably maybe a significant one just in my mind is that we could have gatherings of up to 50 people, and that's if they can maintain social distancing. But that's a little bit different than what we're seeing right now, you know, just out and about. That's something new. And then I think something else that happened was Dr. Hahn went through the criteria in detail that we need to hit to move from stage to stage. And she explained that, you know, it's more than just a downward trend of cases, although that's a factor. She's looking a bit more broadly at, you know, ICU levels and people being admitted to the hospital as important factors.
And I thought that was very interesting because I don't remember the governor or Dr. Hahn going into that much detail before about, I mean, she had a whole slide presentation. I mean, I really kind of felt like we were in kind of a, you know, like a health class almost, right? But in a good way. And Don, I mean, I just don't remember. Has there been that much detail as to what they are looking for in order to go through these phases?
No, and I've either virtually or in person attended all of these news conferences, and that was by far the most detail. And I think in the stage one and stage two news conferences, that was a frustration for people that it was like, hey, we're moving on, the criteria is met, but we're not really talking about it. This time they went into a lot of depth, and I think that's something that often gets a little lost because human beings focus on simple numbers so easily, is it's not just about new cases, as Rachel said. It's about that ICU utilization. It's about hospital utilization. It's about the availability of PPP. I think it's pretty fair to say that we're not going to stop new cases of coronavirus in this state or in this country. It's how do we manage it? How do we mitigate the risks? And how do we keep as many people safe as possible? And that seems to be what the governor has used as his guidance here and has followed through on it, at least as far as I can tell. Now, there has been some issues. You know, Dr. Hahn brought up that there was a big spike last Friday and kind of said, well, that was because of a plant in Jerome. There's new reporting out today that actually was in the news brief at the top of the hour as this airs at noon here on Boise State Public Radio. That comes from the Idaho States from Nicole Foy that talks about this is happening disproportionately in some of Idaho's small counties to people of Latinx heritage and people who are working in these, meat packing and other types of plants. And so there's a difference. Different communities are being hit at different levels by the virus right now.
Right. And she did go into more detail about that, which
it's a great story and folks should read it. Yeah,
it really is. And you can read it. It's Nicole Foy, the Idaho Statesman. But in the midst of this news conference as well, Troy, the governor talked about the cash grant program. Can you tell us what that is for people that may not be aware? And then I know you've got some sound from the governor too.
Yeah, so the Idaho Rebounds Cash Grants for Small Businesses program is what the governor announced earlier this month, and it was a direct state-level injection of cash available for small businesses that were either having difficulty or missed out entirely on the Paycheck Protection Program, the federal program for businesses. And what it's looking like now, this was done in three tiered stages, right? The first tier was for non-self-employed small businesses up to 19 employees. The second phase was non-self-employed small businesses up to 50 employees. And then they just opened it up for self-employed gig workers, contract workers, that type of thing a couple days ago. And what they envisioned originally, from what the governor told me, was a wide-ranging net. They wanted to capture as many people as possible. So they planned this $300 million pot that they had that they allocated for this program. They capped the individual distributions at $10,000 for small businesses, $7,500 for self-employed. Well, to this point in the program, only less than 10% of that $300 million has been distributed or approved for distribution at all to just over 3,300 businesses as of last night. And they were planning for more like 20,000. So it looks like a lot of this money is not going to be used or allocated for the way that it was originally intended. And so we asked the governor what's next, he wasn't really sure. They're looking into it, but he did offer this as specific to self-employed individuals for what he says those people can do now that they have an option between the federal program, the Pandemic Unemployment Insurance federal benefit, or the Idaho cash grants.
The one thing that we're implementing right away is if you are one of those people that had a PUA application in, pandemic unemployment assistance in, and it was a big hassle, you can send a note and say, I'm denying my claim on PUA and I'll take a rebound grant to try and line these programs up.
And this kind of hints at one of the bigger issues here, the big hassle of dealing with some of these Department of Labor programs, both at the local level and the federal level. There are so many different programs and so many hurdles to jump over to get a hold of those that, you know, the governor wants people who have been frustrated or continue to have to wait for some of those federal benefits to just, you can switch over to the Idaho program and you'll get your money faster, assuming everything is lined up the way it's supposed to be, and it will come in a lump sum instead of kind of trickling out week by week.
Right. I mean, and in theory, that sounds good. However,
right,
we have all heard stories of people that, I mean, we're talking mid-March since so many people have been out of work and have maybe right, received one check.
So, yeah, and those stories persist. We're going to continue to hear those and continue to root those out, just because this is a massive workload for the folks at the Department of Labor. And they've rehired recently retired employees. They're bringing people back that they've had to minimally retrain, and they've added some capacity there. But that doesn't make it any less frustrating for people who are still waiting for answers and waiting long times on hold. And you can see that in the disparity between the number of initial claims filed in the state, which is now more than 141,000, compared to the number of people on continuous claim. Week after week, they're getting a check because they remain unemployed. Well, that number is now below 60,000. So you have this huge gap between those two numbers. And what we don't know is, are all those people denied? Are they waiting? Are they back to work? Department of Labor has told me they're working on a way to differentiate, but they don't have it publicly available yet.
Our journalists, Aaron Bamer with Idaho Press, Troy Oppy with Boise State Public Radio News, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Rachel Cohen with Boise State Public Radio News. If you are just joining us, we, in the last segment, talked a little bit about what has happened in the Magic Valley. And Rachel, I want to go back to that because we have seen some spikes in cases, and they come from these food processing plants. Can you get us updated on that?
Right. So the spike that we saw was mostly late last week following some testing at predominantly two food processing facilities in the Magic Valley, one in a potato facility in Jerome and a slaughterhouse in Cadre County in Burley. Both of those are the what the public health district considers the largest clusters so far in its district. And the reason why, you know, one of the reasons why we saw that spike is because those two facilities were able to test a large portion of their employees. But, you know, related to that, the South Central Public Health District published some breakdowns of cases by ethnicity yesterday. And what was revealing from that was just how the Latino population in the Magic Valley has been disproportionately affected by COVID-19.
Right. I mean, Rachel, to the point where, I mean, back on May 20th, Idaho's testing task force said that, especially when it comes to testing asymptomatic people in racial and minority ethnic groups, that it's disproportionately affected by adverse COVID-19 outcomes in these underserved communities, and they have to make it a high priority in our state. But have you heard anything more about if that's actually going to happen and not just, you know, I mean, you can talk about it, but taking action is a completely different thing.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that, you know, the state outlined a testing, the testing task force outlined a testing strategy, and they went into quite detailed notes about who should be prioritized for testing. A lot of high risk groups like people in nursing homes, first responders fall into that priority one category. So do, you know, underrepresented groups in the state, including the Hispanic and Latino population, the refugee population, and the Native American population. And, you know, as was made clear by an answer about a testing question yesterday during the press conference, is that the burden on testing is going to fall on companies if they see a cluster within their employees, or it's really up to the healthcare settings, the hospitals, the clinics, to reach those populations. At least as of now, we haven't heard, a specific plan for the state itself or the health department itself to go out and test these populations.
And I was just going to ask you, Rachel, I know you've been following what's going on with testing. So is that ultimately the answer? The state just doesn't have a plan yet? I mean, where are we with testing, and in particular, like asymptomatic individuals?
Yeah, it's definitely difficult. The state has identified groups that it would like to test, and that's a large number of people. And it right now, it's larger than what we have capacity for. We're getting some help from the federal government. We're supposed to get 40,000 testing kits from the federal government for the month of May. So that should have already happened, and the month of June. And what the state can do is it can distribute those tests to corners of the state where it thinks might need more testing or more attention. But yes, beyond that, it's not clear if there's going to be, any efforts along those lines beside what we receive from the federal government. So
Aaron, I want to bring you into the conversation, Aaron, because in the midst of, all of this and us, start going into phase three coming Saturday, where we are with testing, school for the most part around Idaho is officially, out, or at least out this week. And the majority of kids, ended with being online, being home, with the exception of Nampa Christian Schools. They decided to go back almost a month ago, correct?
Yeah, you're right. Nampa Christian Schools, which is a private school, decided based on an online survey of their parents that they would reopen their schools, both of their campuses, on May 4th, which was about 3 weeks ago, and they just finished up their school year last Thursday, I believe.
And do we know, I'm assuming they put certain measures in place. Do we know too, like, how many kids actually went back? Because I believe they gave parents the option of kids remaining at home or going physically back to school.
They did. Yeah. Parents and students that were uncomfortable with returning could continue distance learning. The school has about 730 total students, which the superintendent said really helped the school to be able to implement safety measures because they have a relatively small student body. They said depending on the grade level, the amount of students that returned kind of fluctuated. But overall, the majority of their students came back to the class between about 55% to about 73%, with the biggest amount of students returning being their elementary level students.
And so we'll learn a little bit more, right, about the measures and all of that. You're going to have a piece in the press coming up soon about that.
Yeah, it actually just came out, I believe, in today's paper. So Some of the measures that they took was shortening class periods down. Overall, their school days were about 5 hours long. They didn't have any lunch periods. They had students eat in their classrooms, and they seemed to implement some pretty strong cleaning and sanitation, to the point where the superintendent said at first people started complaining about getting headaches from the smell, so they actually had to scale back on that. It's interesting, though, because despite there not being very many issues seemingly with Nampa Christian Schools reopening, I don't believe this is very indicative of whether regular schools, other schools and public school districts are going to be able to reopen if we're at kind of the same state in the fall, because Nampa Christian Schools is so much smaller than a typical high school, which has usually over 1,000 students. NEB Christian schools over two campuses, K through 12, has less than 1,000, about 730 students. So depending on where we're at with this pandemic in the fall, it'll be interesting to see whether other school districts implement similar measures or are able to reopen at all.
Well, right. And that's the biggest point I think that you make, Erin, is that, yes, it worked for Nampa Christian School. At least it seems like it has. However, when you are a small private school with less students, you can implement things that when you even have an elementary school in let's say, in West Ada, I mean, you might have a first grade class that maybe there's like four classrooms of first grade students. So it's just so you're dealing with so many more people in the public school system.
Right. The pandemic has really kind of shined a light on a lot of issues with the education system that were already prevalent. And I think the most noteworthy of that is steadily increasing classroom sizes, right? That was already kind of a growing problem before this pandemic hit. And the COVID-19 has really just kind of highlighted how big of an issue it is and made it worse than it was before.
Troy, you had mentioned in the last segment, we talked about the grants, the cash grants program. However, we have numbers now when it comes to April unemployment. These are the latest numbers. And these are, the numbers are shocking in the sense, Troy, that we have more claims now than we do usually in an entire calendar year.
Right. And these numbers, the April unemployment numbers are a little bit different than the weekly numbers. The weekly numbers that we get from the Idaho Department of Labor every Thursday, those indicate how many people have filed for initial claims, how many people are continuing to receive claims. And then some of that data is broken down by sector, by county, et cetera. Monthly numbers, beg your pardon, cover a period from mid-month to mid-month. So April's unemployment numbers cover mid-March to mid-April, and it's done via survey, and it's done by the U.S. Department of Labor, and then with some help from the state departments of labor. And these came out a week ago. They got a little bit lost in the holiday weekend, I think. But you're right, they're staggering. And we knew they would be staggering. If anything, I thought Idaho's number 1.5% higher than any time before, beyond the 10.2% that Idaho reached in December 1982 and the Great Recession peak rate, which was less than 10% in June of 2009. But they still weren't necessarily as bad as I think a lot of people may have expected. And what stuck out to me was the different rates between the different metropolitan statistical areas, is what they call them, MSAs. And this is the Boise metro area, Twin Falls metro area, Coeur d'Alene metro area, et cetera, where Lewiston had a much higher number than, say, Idaho Falls. And Boise was kind of right in the middle in terms of overall unemployment as a percentage and job losses. And it has been interesting to break that down a little bit by sectors. And of course, overall, the Boise area has been hit the hardest because we have the most restaurants, we have the most discretionary spending type of places. But Idaho Falls hasn't necessarily seen that in the same way as the Boise metro area has. So I thought that was the most interesting part of those numbers that came out last week.
And Don, speaking of numbers and places being hit really hard, travelers at the Boise airport, I expected, but can you talk a little bit more about this? Because those numbers really went down.
Yeah, like Troy, I like to look at data, and the Boise Airport provided me with its total passenger data, and I knew that it was going to be a drop off. It's maybe an obvious story, but it still is stunning in its tail. The airport last year saw more people get on or off a plane than ever before. 4 million passengers went through security either in or out, and last December, for instance, 372,000 people went through in a single month. By April, wow, that had dropped to 18,000, just 18,000 people took off or landed at the airport. That's a 94% drop from April of 2019. 94%. Couldn't really, frankly, drop much more than that. We also saw a big decrease in the number of flights. The airport has, and this is about a week old, so forgive me if it's changed because it is fast changing, but the airport has lost direct flights to Spokane. It's lost direct flights to Minneapolis. Those are temporary, but some new permanent flights that were supposed to start this summer, a new flight to Atlanta, which airport officials had worked on getting an Eastern time zone destination for, frankly, a decade, was supposed to start in July. It now will not. They were supposed to start a large multi-year revamp of the airport. That's not going to happen. So this has some real impacts, and the Boise Airport is seeing some significant change right now amidst this big drop in air travel. Mm-hmm.
Well, and all of the statistics are showing, Don, just, I mean, not just nationwide, but worldwide, that air travel is it's going to take some time. For that to come back.
The airport spokesperson, Sean Briggs, told me that that some of the folks are saying, you know, this may be 3 years to get back to normal. And I think it's anybody's guess. It could be 3 years. It could be longer. It's something that I think a lot of folks think about getting on a plane and thinking about sitting elbow to elbow with other people, which frankly wasn't the most fun experience before the pandemic.
Right.
I think it gives a lot of people pause.
Yeah. So, Don, some pretty big waves were made this past week in regards to Boise Mayor McLean's transition documents kind of coming to light.
Oh boy. And in fact, I just sent a note to your producer, Sam. So about this, there's some new developments. So we'll start at the beginning.
Okay.
Boise Mayor Laura McLean formed a series of six transition committees in December to help give her some ideas on where folks think maybe she should focus on her term of 4 years. They did some work. They put together reports. And in April, the city released them all on the city's website. And there's six of them, and there's hundreds of recommendations and lots of pages. Put out a news release. I'll admit that I skimmed them. I didn't look super close and went on with my business, as I think every other reporter did. Then last Friday, Boise Guardian, which has been a longtime critic of City Hall, Dave Frazier, and he posted an item calling it a manifesto. That then got the attention of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, which has been active in politics in the state recently, who called it a socialist wish list. Then on Monday or Tuesday, the Idaho Statesman ran a story that used the socialist wish list in its headline. The mayor's office refused to comment to the Statesman on Tuesday and said, hey, we've got a press briefing on Wednesday. You can ask about it then. And we did. Both myself and Haley Harding over at the Statesman asked a number of questions. I wrote another story. And then the story got picked up today by Fox News.
I just saw this.
So there's the lineage of what happened. Here's the substance of what people are talking about. The transition report called An Equitable City for All has what I frankly call a laundry list of ideas in it. Everything from citywide free internet to increased accessibility to sexual education for pre-K through 12th grade and a whole bunch of other things included in this. And many of them would be a significant departure from the current policies of the city. And many of them, frankly, are just far outside of the bounds of what a city can do. The mayor defended the report and dinged the Idaho Freedom Foundation, calling them a fringe group, and saying that it was, in her words, unfortunate that they would misconstrue this. I asked her how people should know which of the priorities that are listed on that document she embraces and which she doesn't. And while she didn't answer the question and obviously can't answer point by point when you're talking about 350 suggestions across six reports, she said that people should look to her budget presentation for what her priorities were. And then that was made earlier this week. So kind of an interesting dust up that has been kind of moved along by some media and some fringe groups and, you know, landing on the front page of Fox News and has lots of comments. I think we probably haven't heard the last of this dust up.
Right. I mean, you're talking 4,000 comments just so far as it has.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, and the point in the report was it wasn't like set in stone policy. I mean, I think we need to be clear on that, right, Don? But it included recommendations for her priorities as mayor, or what her priorities should be. And, you know, and there, as you said, there were a lot, and they did range the gamut.
Yeah. And I saw a post from a former journalist who completely lost the nuance that these were recommendations for the mayor, not from the mayor. Mm-hmm. And I get why people would lose the nuance. The report is on City of Boise letterhead and colors and uses the city's fonts. And, you know, if you just kind of miss that four and skim it, you think, whoa, this is what she's focused on. The idea, I think, fits within what she ran on, which was improved listening and trying to understand what residents want. And this is maybe the outcome of that. When you take feedback and you publish that feedback, people will then question which things you are interested in focusing on. And really, most of the things in the report aren't in her budget priorities and aren't things that she's announced she'll focus on. She didn't disavow anything in it. She just said these are not policy documents. These are feedback and suggestions on what a diverse group of Boiseans think that we should look at. And frankly, if you read them all and you read every single one, they are pretty diverse. I mean, there's a lot of things that are all over the place, left, right, and center, to be honest. It's not like it's very one-sided, but the Freedom Foundation, you know, gave it some gave it their kind of take, and it went from there, I think.
Yeah, it's a got a little fire after that.
Yes.
Aaron, the Nampa City Council, they just passed an ordinance, and this is regarding liquor license violations.
Yeah, this is kind of a product of months of ongoing discussions from Nampa surrounding the city's protocol for alcohol license renewals and revocations. It mostly the discussion until this point has been focused on alcohol establishments that are within 300 feet of a school or church. The council has made some varying decisions back and forth, granting some requests and denying others. And just recently, they passed an ordinance which ironically doesn't really make very many changes regarding the city's protocol for businesses that serve alcohol within 300 feet of a school or church. It mainly, the biggest thing is it established a point system for businesses with alcohol licenses that have reported violations, giving the city more of a say on what licenses can be renewed and what licenses can be revoked, where previously Idaho State Police and the Nampa Police Department were the main bodies in charge of enforcing the city code when businesses had reported violations.
Hmm. So is this completely in effect then now, or when does it take effect?
Yeah, it just actually took effect on May 26th, I believe. Okay. And so basically how it's going to work is there's varying levels of points that businesses can incur based on the severity of the violation. And it ranges from minor offenses like employees not receiving the required training programs to employees committing severe felonies on the property. All reported violations are going to be reviewed by a committee that I believe has yet to be formed. Depending on the committee's findings, some violations might be reviewed by the council, which will decide whether a license will be renewed or if the points accrued are severe enough, they might choose to revoke a license. And if a business receives more than three or more points, their alcohol license renewal, which was previously just put on the consent agenda, would be put up for a public hearing by the council.
Oh, wow. Dawn, even in the midst of, you know, we talked about our unemployment numbers. I mean, they're skyrocketing right now. You know, our economy's not doing well. However, there could be a big new building coming to downtown Boise in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and I would say the big new building is probably going to happen.
Right.
Idaho Central Credit Union and Ball Ventures all quest to have teamed up to propose a new 16-story building at 4th and Idaho in downtown Boise. 16 stories makes it one of the top five or six tallest buildings in the area. It's kind of interesting because it would include a bunch of different components. It would include a new bank branch for ICCU and some office components. It would include a new Salzer Health clinic location and some offices for Salzer staff. It would also have two different types of residential. One would be aimed at workforce housing for people living downtown, and another would be some high-end condos on the top. And then it's, of course, all topped off with some parking, as many projects
of course.
Seem to be a lot of parking, in fact. So this is an interesting project. Ball Ventures Ahlquist is well-funded by Ball Ventures out of the eastern part of the state, and the participation of ICCU obviously gives it some credibility. I first heard about this project in February, and it took me a while to chase it down, and I wondered when the coronavirus broke out if that would change it, and it didn't. It slowed it just a touch, but they said that they still think that there's a need for this type of product for medical offices and some of these things near St. Luke's Health System, and they plan to move forward. It's going to take about a year to go through the permitting process, and we'll see kind of how that goes, but it would be a big new addition to the Boise skyline that you would be able to see from the rim, and would be a new addition to Boise.
Yeah, you have a rendering on your website. So if people are interested in seeing it, they should, because when you look at it, Don, I mean, it really does overpower what's kind of in that surrounding area already, right? I mean, it's bigger than the courthouse. It's, as you mentioned, it's maybe two or three blocks from St. Luke's, but I mean, bigger than some of those buildings. So it'll really stand out.
Yeah, I think, and you know, our skyline in Boise is interesting because you can look at it on different points of the rim and it has different facets. And so if you look from like the depot, it seems to be kind of in line. If you're more directly on it, it looks a little spaced out. You know, St. Luke's Health System goes up about 11 stories. This is going to be 16. It's right across the street from an apartment building that is, I believe, 12 stories. And it's really only a couple blocks from the downtown core. So it is, and I noted in the story, it is a few blocks from anything of that height, but downtown Boise is growing and expanding, and I think we'll probably see more of this as time goes on.
Yeah, I think you're right. Hey, I want to thank you guys for taking some time out on your Friday to come on the program. We've been talking with Aaron Bamer with the Idaho Press, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Rachel Cohen and Troy Oppie were with us from Boise State Public Radio News a little earlier. Thanks, you guys, so much. Happy Friday.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You too. Absolutely. More Idaho Matters right after this.